This episode of the Your Favorite Book podcast is our season 2 finale, and for that I have to say thank you to the amazing writers that have been wonderful interview subjects and a full wealth of information, to the wonderful books I've had the fortune of reading, books old and new, to the Chicago Review of Books for giving me a platform to share my voice with a wider audience, and of course, to all of you wonderful listeners. I couldn't do this without you. You guys have given me the courage to keep going with this show, and for that, I am eternally grateful. This is the end of season 2 of Your Favorite Book with a guest that is so highly anticipated for me. I can't even begin to tell you, and a book I am so excited to talk about. I think you're going to love this one, and I think you're going to love what season 3, in just a few weeks, will have to offer. Welcome to Your Favorite Book. And for our season 2 finale, this week's guest is the author of Real Life and of the upcoming short story collection, Filthy Animals. Brandon Taylor, how are you today?
Oh, I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
I am so excited to have you on the show today. I'm not sure where you are in the world, but it is super duper hot over here, this nice balmy Chicago summer. I hope the weather's all right where you're at.
I'm your neighbor to the west. I'm in Iowa City. So it's pretty decent today. There's a breeze. The humidity is still there, but it's not so oppressive. So I feel like we're having some decent weather, and I hope it finds its way to you soon.
It definitely comes and goes. I mean, it'll go from 60 to 90 in the blink of an eye, and I've just learned to roll with it here in the Midwest. And so I am super excited to have you on the show today, not only to talk about your upcoming collection, but also to talk about the book today, which is Persuasion by Jane Austen. And I have to tell you, Brandon, I've been running this podcast for about a year now, and I am so surprised that nobody has suggested Jane Austen until now. I feel like everybody loves something by Jane Austen, and I'm really surprised that this is the book that was suggested. I feel like this is an underrated gem, so I'm really excited to talk about it.
Yeah, you know, I'm shocked also to hear that. I mean, to me, Persuasion is her masterpiece. It's, to me, the best Jane Austen novel. So I'm also really excited to talk about it. And, you know, not the least of which is because I'm always thinking about this book, like, constantly.
I love that, because that's the kind of insight we're looking for. And so I want you to hold that all in for now, because we're going to start by talking about your upcoming collection. So as we were saying before we got started, you know, it's a busy week for you right now. I mean, at the time of recording, your book's just a few days away. And when this is going to be out, it'll be out there in the world. How does it feel?
Honestly, it feels really... I have a lot of anxiety because this book is so close to my heart. And so I'm really nervous, but I'm also so excited to finally share this book with the world. I feel like I've been working on these stories for like 5 or 6 years, and I'm just so excited to share it with all the readers. But, you know, I mean, there are a few nerves, but I feel much more relaxed than I felt with releasing my first book last year. I never want to be that nervous ever again.
At least you've done it once. And so it's a different process for a short story collection, but you at least know the drill to a certain degree.
Yeah. I mean, I know the logistics. I know when I'll do interviews, I know how to handle them. I know what the press cycle is like. And so I've acclimated to all the sort of mechanics of it. And so I feel like I get to enjoy it a little bit more this time around.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. And so before we talk about the collection itself, I have to say, I love a good short story collection, and yours was no exception. There's so much you do so well in this collection. You have these wonderful standalone stories. You have some stories that interlock, and it was really great to see those work together and just see it all fit together. I'm going to preface this by saying that your book came at exactly the right time for me, because I was in the middle of taking a short story class on how to write a collection. Shout out Story Studio Chicago. And so this book came at exactly the right time, because something I'm struggling with my own compiling my stories and things like that is the idea of theme, you know, what's tying your stories together. And with
with your book, I feel like you really nail it. Like the stories really fit together so well. And the first thing I want to ask you is, so what's the process for creating a collection? Is it more you have these stories and you're looking for the connective tissue to tie them together? Or is it you have this idea and you're writing stories to convey the idea? Is there like a which one comes first sort of deal?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are like the two paths of a short story collection is you write a bunch of stories and then you notice that there are some commonalities and then you sort of stitch them together. And then there are the people who sort of like maybe write a few stories, realize there's a commonality, and then write more stories to fit it. And I feel like I'm a little bit of an aberration in that I'm neither of those.
Tell me more.
So I tend not to start writing stories until I have a sense of the entire manuscript into which those stories will fit. So I can't even get started until I know that there is going to be a manuscript. So I don't tend to write standalone short stories or just like short stories for the sake of stories. I'm very project oriented. And so I love a project. And so from line one of a story, I know that there will be 5 stories or 6 stories or 7 stories or 11 stories that are all going to form this constellation of characters and themes and stuff like that. And so for me, this book started with, the linked stories in the book started with, I wanted to write a story about a young man who goes to a potluck and he meets people who will sort of change his life or give him some new idea about what it means to live in the world. And so those stories, I started those stories knowing that I was going to follow that narrative across many stories. And the other stories in the book started because I wanted to write a group of stories about like care and caregiving and love and healthcare and all that other stuff. And so those stories sort of coalesced out of it, a sort of general idea. And I at first had 2 story collections. So I had like the Lionel Charles Sophie stories were a book and the Filthy Animals, what I call the interstitial stories, were living in a manuscript. And then I was like, oh no, this is just like the same script. So I found a way to sort of seam them together. And there have been many iterations of the book. You know, some stories have come in and some stories have gone out. But for the most part, really early on, I decided to wed those two groups of stories together. And so like from the very outset, you know, I've always known that there would be the interlinked stories and the interstitial stories. And really it was just a matter of finding which were the right interstitial stories to include in the book.
That makes sense to me. So to simplify it, it's kind of like, you know, you're an album artist or you're a singles artist, to use like a music analogy. And it sounds like you're very much an album artist. You know, you're looking for the broader picture when it comes to putting this together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of it stems from being a very clingy reader. Like as a reader, I don't like to let go of characters. And so when I write stories, I don't like to leave the world because you've done all this effort to sort of like build a world. Like why leave it?
Right.
And so I love a project. I love a manuscript. I can only think of stories in terms of constellations and manuscripts. I can't think of an individual story. Like I find that just like a very unsatisfying thing to write just because I don't want to let go of those characters. And so I love a story collection for that reason.
I really like that. And I love that you brought up some of the matter of the interstitial stories surrounding care and caregiving. I think of the story Mass, which is sort of central on the idea of finding a mass in that healthcare context, but also mass in several other iterations. And I work in the healthcare field. I work in oncology, actually. So that story really hit home for me. I'm a genetic counselor. And so that story really hit home for me. And it helped me tap into some of the anxieties my patients may feel. And then just seeing caregiving and all its different waves, shapes, and forms, and all the ways we seek love and may or may not receive the love that we're looking for. And so I think your collection does such a great job with that. And one thing I'm curious about is we've talked about, I mentioned deep connection and love, but one of the things you do so well is your ability to write awkwardness and discomfort. So I'm thinking of the stories you mentioned, the interlocking ones surrounding the potluck and Lionel, and this ability to show discomfort, which I feel is such a subtle but universal feeling, and it doesn't really get the due it deserves in stories. Can you talk a little bit about writing something like discomfort?
My life is so full of discomfort that it would never occur to me not to want to write it. Like, I mean, I think many of us have had this experience of being in a social situation and you see someone do something that is just like so awkward, and and everybody is like pretending that they didn't see it go down, and you're just like, but I can't unsee it. Like, are we not going to talk about this person doing this kind of awkward thing? And I mean, I love moments like that because it feels like you're getting to see all the social artifice for what it is, artifice, and you're seeing a person behave in like a genuinely human way. And I always feel like it's moments of like genuine humanity peeking up above the sort of artificial calmness of most social interactions. And so I love writing that stuff. But as you so astutely point out, it's difficult because I feel like our culture is like so built around suppressing awkwardness that we don't have a real robust set of verbal tools to talk about it. You know, like awkwardness is that thing that threatens to shut down a narrative or shut down a moment. And so then how do you use the language of narrative to articulate the thing that frustrates and thwarts narrative? You know, it's sort of a paradox. But
yeah,
I love getting in those moments and just like unpacking them and just like following them very closely. My remedy for almost every problem in writing or every problem of articulation is just like close, patient observation. Like you can get over almost any gap in verbal and our sort of you can get over almost any gap in a vocabulary by just being careful and like observing and following the moment through to its conclusion. I think a lot of what happens in short stories tends to be you get to a moment of awkwardness and then the writer just like aborts the scene or like aborts the story and they move on to something that's easier to describe. And I feel like my work is populated with the moments that typically get aborted for whatever reason. And I'm just like unable to look away. So I just keep going.
You can't look away from those moments. And that's when you really get to something new and something different, is when you dig into those moments that people want to overlook or you want to look away from. And you do a great job with that. And honestly, what you're talking about close observation, it's going to bring us very nicely to persuasion when we get there, because that's something this book does so, so well. And then the other thing that stands out to me is the idea of audience and writing for a reader. And so this book, in many of its stories, is focused on queer relationships. And as a straight person, obviously there are things I can recognize, but there are also things that I recognize. These are not the same relationship experience I've seen. And I read this knowing and liking the fact that I may not be the primary audience for these stories. And I feel like I can pick that up as a reader. And you're obviously a reader and a writer. Do you find it easy to tell when someone is going for a specific audience, or is it easy to see when someone's trying to appeal to like the broadest possible audience? Is that an easy thing to pick up as a reader?
I do think sometimes you can tell when, I think that there are moments when I read things or watch things where I feel as though the creator is like being very broad and not very specific and not very particular. And there are moments in storytelling where it feels like there's this inattention to things that would feel as though they deserved more attention and care. Like, for sure, there are moments where it just feels like sloppy, uncareful storytelling. And, but what I know is that I think it's possible for an artist to in their heart really think that they're telling a story to a very specific audience, and the way that like it actually finds its way into the world, like that is not, you know, like that's not the end effect. And so I think authorial intention is sometimes not easily discerned by readers, because readers are bringing their own set of expectations and assumptions to a text. And so I think for better and for worse, sometimes as readers, we project what we imagine that the authorial intention was. And, you know, but there are also moments where it does come through. Like in the case of Toni Morrison, like her oeuvre is so deeply rooted in the subjectivity of her own experience, and her her writing toward other Black women in particular. And like that comes through, like you can't help but to feel like the love and the warmth and the affection and the absolute specificity and care to the impulses that govern, you know, the subjectivity of Black women. And that's a case where it's like, oh yeah, I know who her audience is and I can feel it. But you know, sometimes you can't. Like sometimes people think that they're writing for a particular audience and what comes out is just generalized vague mush. And hopefully revision is what helps you avoid that. But you know, I mean, in the life of every artist, you know, you've got some misses in there. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I think about Toni Morrison. We did an episode on her a few months ago, and thinking of that famous quote that she has, you know, write the book that you want to read. And it's palpable that her audience was herself and her identity, and for women she felt were not represented. And I've really come to love books where I feel like there is a specific audience in mind, and that is who you're speaking to. And even if you're not part of that audience, it's a wonderful thing to witness, even if you're a bit on the outside looking in. It's a privilege as a reader, I feel.
Yeah, and I think that has everything to do with holding in your mind the fact that to write anything is to, you know, it's to be deeply immersed in a very specific subjectivity. And like characters who go on to live in the cultural imagination and you know, in the lives and minds of readers are ultimately those characters who are conjured not from like received notions of groups of people, but from the particular specific granularity of an experience. And that's one thing that Toni Morrison does brilliantly, but also like William Faulkner and Kiese Lehmann, to name a contemporary writer. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the specific granularity of specific subjectivities that I think makes characters and places and literature ultimately live on in the cultural imagination.
Yes. And speaking of those specificities that you mentioned, I want to ask you about dance. Mm. Dance features so strongly in this collection, and it's not a world I've taken Indian classical dance a little bit, but ballet is just its own universe, and you bring in sort of the culture surrounding dance and what it does for body image and self-esteem and other factors in many ways. And I'd love to hear you speak to what inspired you to bring dance so heavily into this collection.
Yeah, so it started one very snowy night in 2016. I was working in lab, and one thing that I would do in lab in between incubations was just like watch YouTube videos. And I somehow stumbled across a video from World Ballet Day that year. And World Ballet Day is like this international thing where, you know, like various TV and media entities go into ballet schools and into ballet companies, and they record morning class, and they have all these interviews with choreographers and dancers and different people in the world of dance. And it was the first time that I had like seen a morning class, like that I had seen them doing the preparatory work that, you know, starts every day in, you know, the life of a ballet dancer. And I thought, well, I've always really loved dance, but I was never allowed to do it as a child because I grew up in rural Alabama, and there are a whole host of reasons I was not allowed to get involved in dance as a child. But, you know, I always felt like it was one of those things that I would never have access to and that I would never be able to understand. And here I was, like, one snowy day, just, like, watching these incredible artists and athletes do their morning preparatory work. And one thing that I know about myself as a writer is that I'm very process-oriented. I love process. I love reading about process. I love watching process. I think about process all the time. And I thought, oh, this is a way that I can access this. This is a way that I can access it in terms of narrative, because I know what it's like to practice. I know what it's like I know what like tensions animate this like high stakes, incredibly self-selected, singular, elite space, because I was in one such space at that very moment. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, like, why don't I just write about a thing that I'm interested in for once and like write about dancers? And that's one of the ways that dance came into the book. And then once I started, I mean, then it was just a matter of keeping going. But I think in many ways I made Charles and Sophie from the linked stories in the book dancers, because I wanted an excuse to write about dance and to finally sort of take a crack at it.
I love that because I love the idea of being able to access things you no longer have access to. And the internet has been wonderful for something like that. And you really made dance feel so real. And I don't think I ever want to dance ballet anymore. I used to think it sounds so glamorous that I see what everyone goes through. And I'm like, maybe not. But it felt very real.
Yeah, I mean, it is incredibly glamorous and it is incredibly beautiful, but it is also incredibly demanding. It's taxing on the body, on one's financial resources. It's this incredibly restrictive space, and it has a whole host of, you know, like the same isms that permeate the larger society occur in ballet. I mean, perhaps even magnified. And it's just like such an interesting test case for so many questions about our larger world and our larger society. So yeah, I mean, it was just a perfect crucible of human drama, I felt.
I love it. And the way you brought it in with academia, another restrictive space that is elite in so many ways and so hard to break into, and even writing to a certain degree, you know, these are all spaces that exist on the outside looking in to a certain degree, but there are ways to access them.
Yeah, totally. And to me, the world of like dance and academia, I feel like those are like the two things I'm obsessed with in my work at this point in my career, where I'm just drawn to these spaces where it's like they have their own rules. Like they're like a very niche reflection of the broader society. And it's like I can't get my head around the sort of like the idea of like writing a big social novel like from the, you know, the mid-20th century. Like the idea of like writing one of those kind of sprawling like social novels, I don't even know what that would look like in 2021. Like it seems impossible. But what I can do is sort of imagine writing about these insular, like almost petri dishes that reflect the broader themes and impulses that permeate our society and culture. And so I feel that in one way, like I'm drawn to dance for that, I'm drawn to art for that, I'm drawn to writing about scientists and ex-academics because that world, I know it so deeply in its granularity, but I also can see its sort of universality and that it mirrors so many of the problems that we have and the questions that we have about the larger culture and society.
And everyone out there, I've always said before how much I love short story collections, but I know they often get overlooked in favor of the novel. I'm going to let you all know that this is definitely a collection you want to pick up. Brandon, you did such a great job bringing these characters to life, and each one of these stories has its own specific texture, and the collection just comes together so well. So definitely don't overlook this book when it comes out.
Well, thanks so much. I'm so glad you think so. Yeah, short stories forever, short stories for life.
Absolutely. And we're going to talk about that more at the end. But now I want to shift gears and talk about something totally different. And I was so pleasantly surprised when you suggested Persuasion as a choice for this book. I came to Persuasion in kind of an interesting roundabout way. So I read this for the first time about a year ago. I majored in English in college, but this was never suggested reading for me. But it was for my younger sister, who took a literature class as like a gen ed in her college curriculum. And they're like, oh yeah, we read this, I think you'll like it. And so I picked it up and I was like, how have I not come across this Austen before? I've read the big Austens, and why not this one? And so to give you some background, if you all don't know this story, so this is Jane Austen's last completed novel. It follows Anne Elliot, who is a ripe old 27 and unmarried. She previously has broken off an engagement to the dashing Frederick Wentworth, a charming man of low social standing due to encouragement from her friends and family. And then later, several years later, she must overcome her own inhibitions, accept her feelings for Wentworth, and dodge a few barriers that stand in their way. So a very simplified summary for a complex novel, but that's the basic gist. And Brandon, I have to know, you know, how did you first find this book and what were your overall impressions?
Yeah, so I came to this book also in a kind of roundabout way. So my very first encounter with Persuasion was many, many moons ago, when as like maybe in my early 20s, I forget when the movie came out, but there was an adaptation of the Karen Joy Fowler novel. I think it's Karen Joy Fowler. She has this novel, The Jane Austen Book Club, and it stars like a pre-Devil Wears Prada Emily Blunt, I think. And it's a novel about a group of women who make a book club, and they all read Jane Austen's novels, and in that they read Persuasion as like the last one. And so that's how I sort of came to understand that there was this author called Jane Austen, and like she had all these books. And then many years later, I was working in a research lab and working very late at night, and I needed some way to like keep my mind engaged while I was doing micro injections into the gonads of C. elegans. And so I started, as one does, and so I started listening to Jane Austen's books on audiobook. Mm-hmm. And so I listened to Sense and Sensibility, and I was like, why did I never read this? This book is so perfect. I love this book so much. Oh my God. You know, listen to, you know, Mansfield Park and Pride and Prejudice and went through them all. And then I listened to Persuasion, and I was like, oh, where have you been all my life? And so my first real encounter with Persuasion was listening to it while I was injecting nematodes in the dead of night in Madison, Wisconsin. And not very long before I wrote the Lionel Charles Sophie stories in this book. So like not long at all before I wrote a lot of the stories in this book. And it was so good. It was so, so good. And I loved it so much. But then the thing is like, once you read Persuasion, then you start seeing how everybody's been kind of ripping it off for years. There are all these movies that are like quietly takes on Persuasion. And I'm just always amazed at the longevity and the potency of this story.
Yeah. And that was actually one of the first things that stood out to me. It's like out of the Austen novels I've read, this is probably the basic plot line, probably the most relatable plot line, and probably the most readily transferable to modern society. It's that idea that you're with someone and you really like them, and then your friends and family are like, oh, you're out of their league, they're no good for you, and they kind of dissuade you from that connection, and then you find your way back to them. And I feel like that's a very tropey way of putting it, but just at its core, like, that's a problem a lot of us can relate to.
Honestly, yeah. Like, the idea of you know, like the idea that like, yeah, you're with somebody and then all your friends are like, dump that loser. And then you do. And then you're like, wow. So I have such regrets. I have so many regrets. But I also think that Persuasion is remarkable among Jane Austen's novels, but like novels in general, because it feels to me like one of the true moments in all of literature where a character changes their mind, like a character, you know, changes their mind, and the author grants that character an opportunity to find love again. And it just feels like, I don't know. I mean, it just feels like one of those moments where it felt like a novel for grownups in that way, because the, yes, you know, the impetuousness of youth, and then you grow up and then you're like, yeah, actually, it maybe wasn't a bad idea that we didn't get married when we were teenagers. And now we're different people. And now we're older, we're wiser, we know more about who we are and what we want, and we're allowed to encounter each other as adults and as mature people, and more as equals, I think. Yeah. And it's just such a sophisticated novel, and yeah, I mean, a lot of people are like, well, it's a romance novel, and I'm like, yes, kind of, yes, but it's also a novel of ideas, and it's a novel about class, and it's a novel about... a novel about women's role in society and female agency, and about one's ability to make choices for oneself. And it takes on all of these, what feels increasingly like the questions of our time and of our day. Like, it feels so deeply modern and so deeply, I mean, it just, I don't know, it blows my mind every time I read it.
It has so much, so many layers to it. A lot of the Jane Austen novels do. And the people who write off Jane Austen as like frilly books for Victorian women, or, you know, or dumbing them down in a way. I mean, there's internalized sexism there, obviously, but there's also just, you know, the aesthetics of the movies often taking over. But there's so much commentary about, you know, agency and economic stability. I mean, the emphasis on marriage and standing, this was a survival mechanism for a lot of the women. I mean, I always think of Pride and Prejudice, and I think justice for Mrs. Bennet. She wanted her five daughters married so they wouldn't be homeless. I mean, that's a realistic want.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, I love the movies, and that, you know, my first encounter with Pride and Prejudice was the Colin Firth miniseries, and I love the movies, and I think to varying degrees, the movies successfully translate the full complexity of what Austen is doing. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like a bad Jane Austen movie is, like, just a romance movie, like, yeah. It's just kind of like a confection, and I feel like the best Jane Austen movies are those ones that maintain that, like, of course the centrality in a life is like love, and how does one find a person to love, and how is a person loved. It sort of preserves that part of it, but it also brings in the humor and the yes. irony and the incisive wit, and those things to me aren't counter to the romance. Like, to me, romance, like, I grew up reading romance novels, and so to me, like, a really good romance novel is funny and is telling us something about society and the world in which we live. And so to me, it sort of brings all those things together naturally. And so I think what happens when people want to dismiss Jane Austen is that they have a really small idea of what a romance is and, like, what a romance novel can do. But so I never feel the need to apologize for Jane Austen's, like, writing about love. And I'm like, yes, love. Who says that love is not an important part of a life? What a silly idea. Like, and not just, like, romantic love, but her novels are also about love between sisters, love between friends, like, love between parents and their kids, and self-love and self-acceptance. Like, her novels are these great, like, expiations of, like, what love is and what love can do within a context of a life and within a context of a society. And I think that they're, and that's why I think of her novels as always being novels of ideas, because they tell us so much about love and so many different kinds of love.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, we've kind of expounded on Jane Austen and her books as a whole, but I want to get into the nitty-gritty of Persuasion. So you mentioned earlier that you find yourself constantly thinking about this book and coming back to this book. And we mentioned the maturity of the storytelling and of the characters, but what are the other facets of Persuasion that constantly bring you back to this book?
Oh, I mean, one is just the dialogue is just so good. Like, the dialogue is so fantastic. You know, that moment where toward the end, Wentworth is like, if I had come back to you, you know, a couple years after leaving with money, would you have accepted me? And the only thing Anne can bring herself to say is, would I? Like, would I have accept? Like, what a question, you know?
Right.
And that, I mean, and also just, like, the great conversations that the characters are having. Like, when Anne is having that conversation that triggers Wentworth's letter, when she's going back and forth with that guy. Is it Bennick? I forget who it is. But she's going back and forth with somebody, and she's like, well, you know, men have feelings. I'm not saying they don't, but, like, women are the ones who've got to carry this torch around in their hearts and yada, yada, yada. And that great conversation about who forgets first, men or women, and who can recover from a broken heart first. I mean, you could put that in a novel today. You know, it's just so the dialogue, for one thing, is just so good and so funny. And I also think about Anne's father, this, like, incredibly vain old man who's, like, always calling his kids ugly.
Yes.
It's so
the first sentence of this book, and I have to share with everyone, I have my copy right here. Let me get past the introduction a bit here. But the first, like, sentence of this book, it says, Sir Walter Elliot of Kellynch Hall in Somersetshire was a man who, for his own amusement, never took up any book but the Baronetage. There he found occupation for an idle hour, et cetera, et cetera. So the only book he'll ever read is the book with himself. And that's the page he always comes to. And it's just, like, what a way to start a book.
Oh, yeah. Like, I think that, you know, sometimes the father figures in Jane Austen's books, like, first of all, none of the I have this, like, unified theory of Jane Austen, that, like, all the men in Jane Austen books are useless. Like, they're all useless. Like, none of them, but especially so in Persuasion. Like, he isn't even particularly nice. Like, he's just, like, a mean, vain old man. And then he's like, we have no money. And then Anne's like, well, maybe we should, cut back. And he's like, cut back? How am I supposed to be this hot if we cut back? So I think it's, you know, so I think about that part of it, the personalities of the characters and the ridiculousness of the things that they do. I also think a lot about how it's a novel so much about property and about renting and about financial precarity. I mean, all of Jane Austen is kind of about financial precarity and about property, but especially so in Persuasion. The stakes are so high for them. Yeah. And, you know, like, what do you do when you're faced with losing your family home and, like, with sort of having to migrate downward in terms of class? Like, what do you do? And how do you get your rich, vain father to, like, change his ways? I mean, it's kind of the story of our time. I think about all of those aspects to it, just like what it tells us about materiality and about material society and how do you maintain comfort, in addition to all the great stuff about love and life. But, like, specifically, what do you do when you run out of money?
Yeah.
How do you live? Where do you go? I guess to Bath. I guess you go to Bath.
I feel like I just saw a meme where it's like, problems to all Jane Austen novels. Just go to Bath and calm down and you'll be fine.
I mean, kinda. That's like the... I mean, I feel like in Jane Austen, you know something bad is about to happen when people go to Bath. Like, they're going, no one goes to Bath of their own volition. Or if they do, it's to, like spirit away a teenage girl from her guardian. Or, like, you, like, a girl's about to trip and hit her head on some stairs. Or, like, a cat is going to hide out somewhere. Like, nothing good comes of going to Bath, but they keep going there anyway.
Right. I think about the book, like, How to Read a Literature Like a Professor, and it's like, here are those tropes you look for, and it's like the cleansing water of the river, the Jane Austen trip to Bath. Like, these are the things that need to be in there. Like, there's your signals.
Oh, yeah.
And I think this book is, it's so interesting that you mention, you know, the implications of financial security, because Anne Elliot, to me, feels like Elizabeth Bennet if Elizabeth Bennet grew up. Because Elizabeth Bennet conducts her life with these ideals that either I'll never marry or I'll find that perfect someone. And thankfully she does, but she doesn't really wrap her head around what happens if she doesn't and what that means for her standing and herself. But Anne Elliot knows that. She's older, she's mature, she's internalized that a bit.
Yeah, I love what you say about Anne being a kind of like, what if it didn't work out between Lizzie and Darcy? I think, yeah, I mean, absolutely. Anne Elliot has seen what happens when your bloom fades, you know, like she doesn't have her youthful beauty, or, you know, like everybody who meets Anne Elliot in the first half of Persuasion is like, wow, what happened to you? You used to be hot. Now you're just kind of like withered and shriveled in your late 20s. and in some ways, like with Pride and Prejudice, I feel like Lizzie Bennet was never in any real danger of having to grow up. You know, like she was so young and idealistic, as you say. And like that character was never going to like, she was never not going to find a rich husband. You know, like that never really felt like a possibility for her. But in a way, Persuasion is about what happens when you don't find a rich husband because you listen to all this bad advice that was maybe good advice, question mark?
Right. We didn't know if Wentworth would be able to provide, or, you know, these are economic realities.
Right. And like, I mean, I always feel like at the end of Persuasion, I'm like, you know, Lady Russell is the real villain of Persuasion. But then I'm always like, well, he didn't have any money. So poor Anne Elliot. You know, she wasn't the oldest sister, so she wasn't going to inherit and yada, yada, yada. And so, yeah, I mean, like, Anne Elliot has real problems. Not that Lizzie Bennet doesn't have real problems, but Lizzie Bennet is allowed to kind of... Lizzie Bennet doesn't have to come up with a solution to her problems, you know? Yes. Lizzie Bennet's like, well, I just won't get married. It's fine. Whereas Anne Elliot is like, well, I'm not married. Also, we have no money. And all of her sisters are looking at her like, we have no money, fix it. You're the person who fixes everything. You're the reasonable one. You're the responsible one. And so Anne Elliot has this whole level of responsibility that Lizzie Bennet also maybe feels, but Lizzie chooses to shirk it. You know, like Mrs. Bennet is like, Lizzie, you have to get married so we won't be homeless. And Lizzie's like, I'll do what I want. I'm a grown-up. Whereas Anne, for a whole host of reasons, does not have that same kind of idealistic headstrongness. Anne is like, well, I guess we better go to Bath and rent this house out because we have no money. And so there's this whole difference of practicality and willingness to sort of shoulder those responsibilities for the family.
I think another benefit to this book, you know, starring slightly older characters, is we also get to see Austen's commentary on parenting and like marriage later on. So bringing back to when I first found this book, my sister read this for a literature class, and she wrote a short paper on parenting in this book, and especially with Mary and Charles and the wonderful scene where they're arguing over who has to take care of the poor sick child when they really want to go to the party. And it's so scathing. I love it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Mary Musgrove. Like, I feel like Mary Musgrove is like one of the great inventions in Austen's body of work, because she is like the quintessential younger sister who gets the hot husband but is still a younger sister. So she's like, I mean, she's been babied her entire life, and when she gets married, she does not grow up. She does not grow up because she's never had to grow up. And so she's got these kids in this great house and yada yada, and what happens when her kid like hurts himself and is sick is that she's like, well, I guess I'll stay, though it would be really sad if I were to have to miss the party. And it's just not fair. And then she's like, but I'm such a bad mom. Why should I have to stay? I'm a bad mom. You know who's a great mom? My sister. She should stay, and I should go to the party. You know, like it's such a younger sibling move, which as the younger sibling, I really relate to. It's so quintessential younger sister, younger brother. And it's one of the funnier parts of the book, like parenting. But then, of course, like, of course, she's a bad parent. Like, look at her model. Her father is like really, her father is like, I saw Anne the other day and she looked so bad. You know, like her father is so scathing and mean. There are no good parents in that book. There are no good parents in Persuasion.
There really aren't. There really aren't. And I love you mentioning the younger sister dynamic. I got to go rub that in my younger sister's face now. But it's so true what we're seeing with some of the other marriages in this book. So juxtapose with Mary and Charles, who have this immature dynamic. Then you get Admiral Croft and Mrs. Croft, who are this companion marriage. Like, they genuinely enjoy each other's company. And I feel like that's what Austen is trying to show us with this more modern, more mature novel. It's like, there are a lot of reasons to marry, but there's also just the need to like each other's company. It's such a basic thing, but it really needed to be said.
Honestly, yeah. And I think that's part of the magic of the novel, is that in some of Austen's other novels, marriage is like the magic bullet. You know, it's the thing that causes the young girl to mysteriously grow up and to become a woman, you know, like at the end of Pride and Prejudice, like Lizzie Bennet is no longer this headstrong, impetuous young girl. She has bloomed and she's gotten married and she's now going to be, you know, Mrs. Fitzwilliam Darcy. Mm-hmm. And in Sense and Sensibility, of course, there's Marianne, who's like this headstrong, like romantic, passionate girl. And then she gets a harrowing illness, like low-key depression is what it is. Mm-hmm. But she gets a harrowing illness, and then she gets married, and then she grows up and becomes, you know, this like beautiful, like mature person. And I think that sometimes marriage is used as a kind of like magic. It's going to solve all the problems. And what Persuasion shows us is that marriage won't necessarily make a person grow up. Like, Mary Musgrove is still Mary Musgrove. She's still Mary Musgrove. But what I also do think, though, is that the marriages among the older characters in Persuasion they all seem so great. Like Charles Musgrove's parents, they seem really great. They seem like they're real chill. They have a party, they go around, they hang out. It seems really lit. It's the younger marriages that are just kind of like, especially the ones that are made on the basis of like real sort of dubious intentions, like for money, it doesn't seem to work out. And I love that the novel is making this subtle argument about why one marries being a really important question to answer, and not saying that like a marriage for money is inherently like faulty or bad, but, you know, look at the Crofts versus look at Mr. Elliot's first marriage. You know, I mean, it's a really lovely, subtle argument about the basis of a marriage, for sure. Although maybe not so subtle.
Absolutely. And
because she kills that first wife. Jane Austen kills Mr. Elliot's first wife.
Yep. It's like, you're done. This is over. And so I want to bring this back to your work a bit. Would you say that there are aspects of this book that have influenced your own writing? And if so, do you think you could articulate how that might have happened?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think persuasion is so deeply ingrained in all of my work, in all of my stories, and in my novel. I think one of the ways that it's influenced me most is just the ability to write characters who are so fully realized that they're capable of making, quote unquote, the right choice, and then later on realizing that they made that choice on the basis of a set of like narrow circumscribed options, and now they have other options and they're free to change their mind and to act with agency. I think all of Jane Austen's characters act with incredible human agency, and the way that she's able to sort of get you so deeply into their circumstances that you understand why they make the choices they make, even when those choices feel so restrictive and painful and awkward to watch. And I think she writes,
yeah,
I think she writes without a lot of judgment. I think sometimes she's very judgmental, but that judgment always feels like it's coming from a very particular locus within the story and the narrative.
Yes.
And so that's another thing that I've taken from her, is just like the deep specificity of a story's texture in terms of its, you know, its moral vision. But overall, I think the biggest thing is just being able to write a character who can change their mind, and it feels earned and honest and authentic, and it feels like it's coming from a real place that's driven by that character's changing understanding of their circumstances. I think that's like, for me, it was revelatory, because before that, all my stories were like, well, I'm going to make him do this, and then I'm going to make that character do that. I'm going to like bash them like action figures. And reading Jane Austen taught me that, like, oh, it's not just bashing action figures. These actions and thoughts have to come from a real deep human place.
Yeah, I can't think of a better way of putting all of that together. It's just the movement of these characters, and understanding that the choices they make and why they make these choices, and understanding that, like, the best stories, you imagine that these characters go on after the story has ended, or had a life before these events too. And I think you really get that feeling with Persuasion.
Yeah, totally. And that's the thing that I want most in all of my writing, is I want it to feel like for the length of the story, you're just seeing a small part of this character's life, and that there was a life before it and there's a life after it, and we get to hang out with them for this very narrow period of time. And yeah, that's the thing that I'm always trying to do in my own work, and it's not easy. It is so hard.
It's so hard to write well, and everyone who says short stories are easy to write, they are not. They may be shorter than novels, but they're not easier to write.
Yeah, I mean, short stories take the same amount of diligence and focus and care and love and attention that writing novel. I mean, I wrote my first novel in 5 weeks. It took me 5 years to perfect the title story of Filthy Animals, you know. So the length of a book doesn't necessarily tell you anything about the scale of the work involved.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And kind of going along that, this is when I like to open the floor for recommendations. You know, we've talked about some excellent books here, but I always like to ask my guests for a recommendation or two. And so, as I mentioned before we started, I'd love to hear first maybe a book you'd recommend for someone who has read and really enjoyed Persuasion.
Okay, so I think a book that is in the same vibe but is like so good and so breezy is Emma Straub's Modern Lovers. I read it right after reading Persuasion, and I was like, now wait a minute, why does this feel like this stuff? Why does it feel like the same stuff? And Modern Lovers is just like such a brilliant novel. It's set in contemporary Brooklyn, I think, and it's about these two groups of friends, and they've got to grow up and make some grown-up choices. And it's just so, it's full of all this great writing about food and music and life and love. And yeah, I just love it so much. I think about it all the time. And the dialogue is so sharp and crisp. And yeah, she's such a brilliant writer. And she runs a bookstore. Books are magic. So, I mean, she's doing it all for this community.
That is amazing. Oh, I need to check that one out. I've definitely heard of her store and I've heard her name, but I need to check out that book.
Modern Lovers. And it's so good. It's so
Modern Lovers.
And it's very Jane Austen-y, for sure.
I love that. Absolutely. And then turning back to short stories, as I mentioned, I feel short story collections are unsung heroes. People need to read more of them. What are a couple of short story collections that you think, you know, need their day in the sun?
Okay. So I think Andrew Martin's short story collection, Cool for America, is so good. And I think that in 10 years, it's going to be one of those modern classics that we all carry around in our backpack and that we all talk about, kind of like Mary Gateskill's Bad Behavior became a touchstone. I just think it's, Andrew Martin is such a great writer, and he writes about, you know, being like 28 to 35. And it's just really, really so deeply observed and so funny and wry and so true. And it's just really incredible. And I think that everybody should read that book. I think it's going to be a real sort of touchstone for a generation. And I also think that Danielle Evans' short story collection, Department of Historical Corrections, is so brilliant. Mm-hmm. And I think Danielle Evans is a genius. I think that she is maybe America's best living short story writer. And everybody should read her, read both of her collections, but especially this newest one, Department of Historical Corrections. And if I just say one more, I think Ben Marcus's latest collection, Notes from the Fog, is kind of a sleeper hit, honestly. I think it came out a couple of years ago, and it has all these great sort of slightly speculative stories about the strangeness of living in contemporary society. And Ben Marcus is a brilliant writer who needs no introduction, but Notes from the Fog, I would love for more people to read that book just because it was such a knockout for me.
Oh my gosh, I need to find all of these now as I'm working on my own work and starting to really appreciate short story collections. I'm definitely finding all of these, and I urge you to check them out as well. Short story collections, everyone needs to read more of them. Yeah. They're so excellent.
They're so great. Like they're so, it's so good to just like hang out in a sensibility for a while. And
yes.
Yeah. And like, it's like getting punched in the gut over and over and over. Like reading a novel is like maybe sort of like slowly, like sitting in the pot that's like slowly getting hotter. But reading a short story collection is like getting struck by lightning 12 times in a row. It's just, there's nothing like it.
That is such a good way of putting it. And I absolutely love that. And so before we wrap up today, Brandon, where can we find you and where can we find your work?
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter, usually, at BLGTYLR, and on Instagram at just Brandon LG Taylor. And on my website is a link to all of my work, essays and such. And that's BrandonLGTaylor.com.
That is absolutely wonderful. And everyone, take a look for Filthy Animals and, of course, Brandon's other book, Real Life. These are excellent books that are out there and deserve to be read. And if you haven't read Persuasion, maybe you think you've read all the Jane Austen. You have not read all the Jane Austen. Persuasion is definitely worthy of your time. Brandon, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure and always a joy to talk to a fellow Persuasion lover.